The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, FA Cup. Tim Burr as Forest fell Leicester and the Woods pipped the Cherries. Meanwhile, no food provided, but no shortage of booze or well-fed up fans as Man United bow out to Borough. We round up all the stories from the fourth round, hear about Sunday night's Cup of Nations final, the climax with the Mane shot, and throw forward to a round of midweek games in the Premier League with league debuts for Frank and Roy and so much more. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Monday the 7th of February. Hello to you, listener, and thank you for being with us today. Today's Totally features, who we got? Carl Anker.
Ahoy, ahoy, James.
Ah, lovely stuff, Carl. Matt Davis-Adams is also with us.
Hello, James. I'm feeling a little hoarse this morning, I must say.
Lucky horse. And Flo Lloyd-Hughes also with us. Hello, Flo.
Morning, James.
Excellent stuff. Matt, your current status is listed as loving Nottingham Forest FC.
That's true, yeah. Still on a high after Sunday's magnificence, which I'm sure we'll talk about more, as indeed we must.
Indeed. So, Flo, you're looking for some space in your relationship with QPR, I think. Carl, remind me who you support.
That's so unserious.
There's a lot of football to discuss. Some of it good, some of it bad. There's loads coming up as well. We've got a midweek round of fixtures, the Club World Cup and that, AFCON final for Sunday night. But I think FA Cup is probably the place to begin. The fourth round taking place Monday to Sunday. It's all the holders, Leicester, exiting the competition thanks to a triumphant performance by the aforementioned Nottingham Forest. It also saw Borough take Man United to penalties Friday night and then put them out. And on Sunday, a huge upset on the South Coast as non-league Bournemouth beat Bournemouth 1-0 away. Elsewhere, Saturday's sixth-tier Kidderminster was seconds away from becoming one of the competition's greatest upset winners ever. Narrowly missing out, West Ham going through. Meanwhile, Man City, Liverpool, Chelsea all made it through. Chelsea getting a bit of a scare from Plymouth. Spurs, Palace and Saints won 2, as did Norwich, who were victorious at Wolves. And Everton, who in Frank Lampard's debut, beat Brentford 4-1. It means that all the last 16, all the fifth round teams are now Premier League or Championship, with one exception, and that's Boreham Wood. Wow. Matt, you were at City Ground for the victory over Leicester. Carl, you were at Old Trafford for the mealless penalty shootout exit.
Unfortunate 71,000 without any half-time food.
Yeah, brutal. But let's begin with extraordinary Boreham Wood. How massive, how heartwarming, especially after Kidderminster's heartbreak. How delighted were you with this upset?
It's kind of one that suits everybody, I think. Boreham would obviously get the massive tie in the next round and the glory of having beaten Bournemouth. And Bournemouth can go back to doing what they're really here to do this season, which is get promoted. So I don't think that Scott Parker will be particularly fussed about it, albeit, you know, heavily backed in the transfer market. So a little bit more pressure on him now. But yeah, I mean, Boreham would deserve to win the game, partly because Bournemouth were pretty terrible in it. But Boreham Wood came with a brilliant game plan and executed it. And, you know, the fact that their goal scorer was older than their manager was quite a nice little quirk to it, I thought.
Yeah, I think just to follow up on what Matt said as well, I suppose the only concern for Scott Parker might be just the manner in which they created so little. They had 600 passes more than Boreham Wood, which for Bournemouth, they're a team that do like to have a lot of the ball. But I think is very sort of cliche, one team wanted to win it more than the other. And that is hard, I think, when you play non-league sides, because obviously they're going to play a simpler brand of football, and they're going to do the basics very well, not going to create a whole lot, but they're probably going to take their chances. They're going to be very physical, and I think that was really hard for Bournemouth to deal with. I think they looked tired. They weren't really reacting very well to a lot of what Bournemouth were coming with, and they completely deserved it. It wasn't like a smash and grab. Before they scored that goal, they had plenty of chances. So I think Scott Parker might be a little bit more concerned in kind of the manner in which they lost that game, but there's so much pressure on him to get them up, because they have put a lot of money into promotion. So if that doesn't happen, they could be in a bit of trouble.
Boreham Wood, the Wood. Matt, you mentioned the game plan perfectly executed. 18% of possession in this match, just one shot on target. But they continue their extraordinary feat of not conceding a single goal in this competition so far. More about the game plan, Matt.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was kind of weekend of showing that, you know, organisation can often trump talent. I saw that almost happen at Stamford Bridge on Saturday. But the manager, Luke Garrard, who I was a huge fan of, my radar is usually up for false humility in these kind of situations from the non-league side. But to watch him kind of silently weeping in front of his supporters at the end of the game was quite beautiful after he'd done a post-match interview where he said, yeah, Bournemouth's goal was disallowed. That wasn't offside, and just kind of seeming like quite a genuine, nice guy. But it was, you know, Bournemouth had a new goalkeeper, Freddie Woodman, making his debut. They insisted on playing out the back. And so part of the Boreham Wood plan was, well, let's just put loads of pressure on them, press them really high, try and win the ball back. And it worked time after time after time. And they were happy to let them have the ball kind of in the middle of the pitch or even near their goal, knowing that they were just going to not only have their four defenders inside the penalty area most of the time, but most of their midfielders as well. And just sheer weight of numbers meant that Bournemouth couldn't find a way through them. And it was, you know, it was not a particularly sophisticated game plan, but if everybody sticks to it for the entirety of the 90 minutes and Bournemouth's reserves aren't really up for it, then this is the consequence.
Brilliant. This is, of course, the club where Chairman Danny Hunter had to remortgage, or chose to remortgage, his house during the lockdown to help the club survive the financial effects of football shutting up shop. So it's magnificent for them. They go to Goodison in the fifth round, as Matt, you mentioned, which means we will get Lampard v. Garrard, which, you know, one vowel away from having all sorts of narrative to it. Well, that's grand for them. Lovely. A shame for Kidderminster, though. A nation watched agog as they came within a couple of minutes of becoming the first sixth-tier side ever to put out a top-division team in the FA Cup. Wow. And then at the end of extra time as well, heartbreak again.
Yeah, I think this was basically just like Declan Rice FC versus right. the world. West Ham were pretty poor until he came on, and he completely changed the game and essentially decided that he was going to change the result and carry the team on his back and get them through to the next round. Without him, West Ham definitely would have dropped out of this competition. And it's a brilliant competition for them. It's perfect for a team like West Ham. Obviously, they have still got the Europa League to be in contention with. But I think for a team like them, they need to be getting to the latter stages of cup competitions to kind of show their status and their growth. So it would have been so huge for them to be knocked out. Kidderminster defended really well. And I think by the time it got to stoppage time, I think everyone had kind of accepted the fact that Kidderminster were going to go through because West Ham were really struggling and not playing
the
well.
The camera pulled back for to kind of put the final score caption up. And everything was set for fans to run on the pitch.
Everyone was ready. And then Declan Rice just completely transformed it. And I do think it was one of those moments where when that goal went in, I think it felt like the Kidderminster players just had nothing left to give. They had used up so much energy defending their goal and defending it really well that was it. They just couldn't give any more.
Extra time was a bit of a siege before Jared Bowen, again, right at the end of 120 minutes when it looked like we were set for penalties, got the winning goal for West Ham. Lovely pictures afterwards, though, of David Moyes sharing a beer with the Kidderminster manager, Russell Penn. I don't know if you saw the unique configuration of the Kidderminster manager's office where Russell Penn's got a proper desk, and then to fit the assistant in, he's got... Do you remember the desk you used to have at primary school with the lift up? That's more or less...
It was a tiny, tiny little desk.
It's very much kind of nailing the assistant to the manager rather than assistant manager.
Yeah, it was definitely a power move.
Why didn't West Ham buy a striker, by the way, in January? I mean, this game really just highlighted that.
West Ham have bought so many strikers since 2010, I think. Maybe they decided, let's just, for once, let's just not buy a forward player. Let's not do that. We haven't had the best record. They are a really curious squad in that pretty much anything they achieve for between now and the rest of the season should be considered a great achievement for how far they've come since the pre-COVID era where fans were protesting on the pitch. But it will feel a bit like a wasted opportunity if they don't quite get there due to their lack of squad depth.
Well, they've still got their irons in plenty of fires, if you'll excuse the expression. They've got Saints in the next round. Saints who beat Coventry 2-1 in extra time. I'm sure we've all marvelled at the curl on on the Armstrong goal in that one. Elsewhere, Matt, let's hear about Nottingham Forest putting out the holders, Leicester 4-1. You were there, singing your Depeche Mode at the final whistle.
Yeah, I mean, more video in my mum singing Depeche Mode at the final whistle, but I won't.
Is that available on social media?
Can you drop that in the pod?
I'll put it in a WhatsApp group. I think she might be slightly uncomfortable given her. Her singing voice is not her biggest quality, but she certainly enjoyed herself, as did I. I mean, I honestly think this was the best atmosphere I've ever known at a Forest game ever. I mean, that's quite a low bar because it's been almost a quarter of a century of abject misery. And so when days like this come along, the fact that it's a 4 o'clock kickoff, I think probably played a bit of a part in that too. But I kind of want to do some analysis about the game, but it was a bit too emotional for me to do that, really. I was at the behind the goal where Forest scored the three goals in the first half in 9 minutes, and they did just absolutely obliterate Leicester, who started far better than Forest and had a couple of chances to go in front. But my goodness me, they crumbled in a way which was quite alarming if you're a Leicester fan. But Forest were brilliant, and that's what Forest had been since Steve Cooper came in, basically.
Yeah, I follow a lot of Leicester fans on social media, and I think you could tell as well from Brendan Rodgers' post-match that it does feel like a real pivotal moment for them, this defeat. I know it's been a really difficult season because the fans that I follow have been tweeting a lot about how miserable they are, so that's when you know you get a sense of the general vibe. But they've obviously had a lot of injuries, so defensively they've struggled. Soyuncu, I don't know, like, who decided that he was a good player. I think I've decided that he had two good games once on telly, and that's kind of defined his narrative. And then I think the Euros proved, and this season's proved, that actually he's not very good. But he's really struggled. A lot of their defenders have struggled, the ones that have been fit. But it does seem like from Rodgers' post-match that he's realising that this could be a big moment for them in terms of, is he going to stay and how they change things? Because he admitted that this group have been together for a very long time. Feels like perhaps energy levels, commitment levels, motivation has dipped a lot. And I think he's feeling like something's got to change. Perhaps it's him, or they need some new energy in the dressing room. But it certainly feels like one of those moments where a squad is just not pushing each other anymore. There's not competition for places, probably because of injuries. It's like, you know who's going to have to play. And therefore, it just doesn't seem like they want it that much anymore. And I think I saw a tweet yesterday, a guy saying that this is worse than the darkest days of the Claude Puel era. So I don't know how you change it. Obviously Brendan Rodgers has given them so much, and that FA Cup win is something that they'll never forget. But at the same time, what do you do now? Because it's certainly been a really poor season so far.
Mm-hmm. Brendan Rodgers talking about some players potentially having played their last game for Leicester, which does sound ominous. But Forest, though, what's going on with this remarkable record, Matt, that they have against the holders, beating the 2020 winners Arsenal in round three and then Leicester here? But am I right? This is off memory, but is it six of the last eight times you've met the reigning FA Cup champions, you've put them out?
Yeah, it's a weird one. I mean, obviously, circumstantial. Arsenal just didn't turn up, didn't play with a decent striker and had nothing of the game, and Forest beat them easily. But, I mean, it's a nice little quirk that Forest do well in the FA Cup, but they have a legitimate chance of getting promoted this season, and that, it feels like not a now or never moment, but almost, to be honest, because Brennan Johnson and Jed Spencer are Forest's two best players at the moment by quite a wide margin, and that's not too denigrate the contributions of people like Joe Worrell and Steve Cook, and Forest had a really good transfer window. But Johnson and Spence won't be at Forest next season if they're not in the Premier League. And Steve Cooper might not be at Forest for very much longer if they don't get in the Premier League this season either. So I do kind of feel like if Forest are to get promoted, this is the best chance they've had in a long, long time. So the FA Cup's been nice. Yesterday was brilliant. One of my favourite games that I've been to in many years. I remember it for a long time. But I would rather go out to Huddersfield in the next round and get in the playoffs than, you know, get to the semi-final or the final of the FA Cup.
You big softy, Matt. That's really depressing. You can think that, but don't say it.
Okay, and look, I wouldn't normally think it if it hadn't been nearly 25 years since Forest have been in the Premier League. And let's be honest, Forest aren't going to win the FA Cup this season anyway. I mean, they've got the the inclination is to say, well, you've got a good draw in the next round, Huddersfield at home. Well, they beat us at home last month and they're higher than us in the league table at the moment. So there's nothing to say that Forest are automatically going to win that
game. I suppose with the FA Cup dream, I think for a lot of fans, it's like, oh, well, it's inevitable that you, however far you get, you will probably lose to a Premier League side at some point, whether you come up against Manchester City, Chelsea, Liverpool. You know, you're probably going to lose to one of those three teams. So it's almost like you're delaying the inevitability of it. And therefore, if you've got a big target in the league, you should focus on that rather than chasing a pointless dream when it's still going to be one of those big sides.
That sort of defeats the whole...
The magic is reaching your, you know, peak, but I think for a lot of fans who probably maybe have seen their club get to the fourth and fifth round quite regularly, it's like, well, actually, you know, what's the point if we know that there's a bigger objective this season?
I wouldn't say it's a case of what's the point. I think what you do is you enjoy the occasions in isolation and don't worry too much about the next round. So regardless of what happens to Forest against Huddersfield, I will still have absolutely loved what happened on Sunday yesterday. Things like, you know, Joe Worrell, who was Forest captain yesterday, had two crack ribs, was supposed to be out for 6 weeks, came back after two, had a sort of improvised cast that they'd made for him, tackled somebody with his head and then scored a goal. You know, that kind of thing goes down in Forest folklore. And what did Leicester offer him? Respond? Some dope coming on the pitch trying to punch, you know, the biggest bloke on the pitch who will never watch a football game again.
Oh, yeah. Well, what's happened to the individual in question?
Leicester, in fairness to them, very swiftly. I was right in front of this, by the way. I had a perfect view of it. Came on and punched Keenan Davis as hard as he could in the face, which was an absolutely shocking thing to see. And Leicester, I think less than an hour after full time, put out a statement saying, we know who this guy is. He's banned from every home and away game for the rest of his life. So
right. Credit to Davis and the group of Forest players that he was with, that they didn't respond.
They did. They had a couple of swings back and,
oh, did they?
And
okay.
Clipped him, I think. Yeah, which is absolutely fair enough. I mean, how must he be feeling this morning? What's he going to do? Plead not guilty? Well, there's 3 million people watching it on telly who saw it, so good luck with that.
Leicester's week will see them take on Liverpool Thursday in that Premier League midweek round. Liverpool, who are 3-1 winners over Cardiff. A game which featured Luis Diaz making his debut off the bench, and also the return of Harvey Elliott, who made light of having a dislocated ankle, fractured ankle?
Broken ankle, yeah, very much.
Broken ankle, which is, you know, no laughing matter, with that extraordinary goal.
Better than Stuart Armstrong's?
No, I think Stuart Armstrong's probably got the goal of the FA Cup weekend.
Really?
I'm going to give it that way. It was a very sweet hit.
Jan Valery encouraged to shoot. Armstrong does! Oh, I say! That's absolutely wonderful!
Certainly was. Flo, who would you give it to?
I would give it to Armstrong as well. I agree with Carl. I think, obviously, the narrative around Elliott's comeback makes that goal a lot sweeter. But I do think, for pure technique and swerve, and the camera angle as well that you get on that Armstrong one, I think that adds to the finesse. So whoever produced and edited that has helped, I think, sway things towards Armstrong's goal.
Yeah, nice. That's fair. Charlie shared a gif of it with us before the show, and like I watched the highlights of the game and watched the goal and watched the replay. I thought, oh, that's good. And then when I saw the gif, I realised that sort of 7 minutes had gone past and I was just watching the gif.
Oh, yeah, it's hypnotising, isn't it? It's amazing.
But the first touch from Elliot was outrageous.
Fantastic. Elliot is... I'm trying to find the right superlative to describe him. But he's... both in him and in Curtis Jones, Liverpool's central midfield as well, stock for the future. Which, I'm not supposed to get too excited about the possibility of Jurgen Klopp staying at Liverpool and creating a new great Liverpool side. But he's sure got a nice plan for it, hasn't he?
I'm going to say it's a gif.
Oh, okay.
That's how I roll.
Okay, fine. Yeah. You said that.
Hello again, listeners. It's Kyle Monaghan here from Paddy Power. Lend me your ears and I'll tell you a tale. All eyes will be on Everton's trip to Newcastle this Tuesday as Frank Lampard takes charge of the Toffees for the first time in the Premier League since his appointment. Of course, he got off to a brilliant winning start, thrashing Brentford at the weekend in the FA Cup. He'll also be able to call upon the services of new signing Dele Alli, as the former good player was cup-tied last weekend. One would hope that the friendly arm around the shoulder approach might get Ali's career back on track, or at the very least, get him to sort out his Barnet. There's also plenty going on with Eddie Howe's Magpies, as they'll be showing off some of their shiny new signings. The Man Mountain, that is Darren Byrne, has come in from Brighton, and that should improve things at the back. Matt Targett comes in on loan from Aston Villa and will slot in at left back. The most interesting signing is the one of Bruno Guimarães from Lyon. The Brazilian midfielder has the powers to transform how the side will move the ball, so it'll be vital for Newcastle's survival hopes that he settles in quickly to his new home. Kieran Trippier and Chris Wood were the first two lads in the door at the beginning of last month, and as expected have come straight into the starting 11. So the Newcastle project is well underway now, listeners, and the race to beat the drop really starts now on Tuesday night. Newcastle are currently odds of 8-13 to stay up after their shopping spree. In terms of this game, though, the Paddy Power trainers have made Newcastle the slight favourites for this one at 8-5. The draw is 9-4, and Everton are priced up at 17-10. So, listeners, the Saudis have put their money where their mouth is so far, so let's all sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com, or indeed the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s. T's and C's apply. BeGambleAware.org. And remember, take time to think.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Liverpool will be hosting Norwich. I mentioned Leicester for them this week, but it's Norwich in round 5 of the Cup. And Norwich should beat Wolves. There's a lot of stories out there in the FA Cup fourth round. Amongst them, Man United, Carl, Friday night. 1-1 at the end of 120 minutes with Middlesbrough. Borough going through 8-7 on penalties. And you were there. I hope you took sandwiches or something.
Some snacks.
Yeah, that was a very strange game. So around about the 40th minute, Tannoy Stadium announcement said there would be, due to a technical error, no food or drink would be sold in the concourse, which created quite very loud boos from the 71,000 in attendance at Old Trafford, and some chants of "We want Glazers out." This was a Man United performance that, and I don't want to use the word dominant, because right, Manchester United haven't put in dominant performances from minute 1 to minute 90 in so long that if they have 20-minute patches of competency, sometimes my eyes go, ooh, this is nice. This is more of the smash and grab FA Cup victory, sort of, you know, United get the early penalty, Cristiano Ronaldo pulls that wide, Bruno Fernandes misses an absolute sitter, Middlesbrough's goal involves an accidental handball that I don't really know how, well, I know the rules as to how that now works, but Chris Wilder admitted after the game that he very much expected that goal to be chalked off, and a penalty shootout where the quality of the penalties, depending on your opinion, were either really good and no goalkeeper could save those, or were quite average and both goalkeepers should have saved at least one more. Very strange game. I think the thing for Manchester United now is, do you prefer to watch a better plan being executed to a mediocre degree, or the sort of freestyling plans of the previous managerial era? Do you like watching long blues freeform jamming sessions, or do you like watching amateur opera?
I don't like either of those things, Carl. What do I do?
Just don't watch Manchester United as
Carl,
a thing.
Carl, where do you
right
stand
now
on it?
The tactical plan and the principles that Ralf Rangnick is trying to bring to this Man United team are good. They are very much how most modern football teams want to play. So something we saw quite early on in this game in the 4-3-3 was Scott McTominay, deepest central midfielder, would drop between the two centre-backs. So it'd be 3-2, give more space to the centre midfielders in front, and really help with build-up. That's how basically Bayern Munich do that in build-up. England did that in build-up at the Euros. Liverpool do that in build-up. There were parts of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's Man United where Nemanja Matic would do that. And they did that for about 20 minutes. And then McTominay stopped doing that. And I don't know why. And I don't know if it's just a tactical instruction or if Scott McTominay just forgot that that's his new job. And this happens every now and again. So that the Bruno Fernandes' chance was created because Cristiano Ronaldo sort of ran up to try and press the goalkeeper, causing the goalkeeper to panic to pass it into central midfield where Fernandes was waiting in it as a midfield trap, won the ball and sprung forward. That's what Ralf Rangnick wants to do. That's how Southampton score loads of their goals in 2019-20. That's good football. But the execution of both of those ideas was half-hazard, didn't last from minute 1 to minute 90. So you're going, maybe this is good enough to finish in top four. I don't think they're the favourites for top four. I don't think they're favourites for most of the things they want to do. And the right. only real reason I'm still excited, well, reasonably excited about the rest of the season is because Atletico Madrid are bad.
Hmm. Atletico Madrid got pumped this weekend by Barcelona. But yes, I do want to ask you a little bit more about the Lingard situation because I missed out on that entire soap opera over the last couple of days. But first off, a note for myself here that reads, before Carl goes ranty, get some love for the Borough. Have you got anything nice to say about Borough?
I can say something nice about Borough.
Please do, Flo.
I know Carl mentioned the penalties. I was of the opinion that Borough's penalties were pretty impressive. I think maybe five or six out of the eight went right in the corner. One of them was actually smashed into the top corner. Some intriguing styles, I would say. but at the end of the day, they all were well executed and right in the corner. Joe Lumley, former QPR goalkeeper, I don't think ever saved a penalty during his time at QPR, but I appreciated the way he celebrated the penalty shootout like he had saved the winning penalty and not the other way around, and not just got away with it. But yeah, I think it was a good performance. I think they still kept themselves in the game. I mean, Matt will be able to say as well how much that they've improved under Wilder from where they were under Warnock, which was so turgid. So I think it's a big lift for them to be able to show that they can kind of compete and contain a side like United, even though they were sort of probably living on the edge for a lot of parts of that game.
Mm. Yeah, it's good. It's good for Chris Wilder because you know, people who don't follow the Championship will kind of associate him with how terrible Sheffield United were last season. Now, but he is an excellent coach, which he showed here. Great for Sol Bamba as well, by the way. I mean, having recovered from cancer to resume his career and kind of taken to Middlesbrough because he's one of Neil Warnock's henchmen, and essentially for as much what he does off the pitch as what he does on it, but kept on by Chris Wilder. Scored his penalty magnificently here and then went full lethal weapon on Twitter afterwards, simply tweeting, "I'm too old for this S," three star emojis, three crying laughing face emojis.
That picture was so funny.
Yeah, so all these players are celebrating and he's just standing there. Yeah, great, brilliant. I've kind of got this in perspective. It's just a penalty shootout winning the FA Cup.
Right. United, by the way, have lost seven of their last eight penalty shootouts. What is that about?
I think their only victories against Rotherham.
Is it? All right. When it counts, say Carl. Ralf Rangnick and Jesse Lingard. But take me through, if you can, with bullet points, this unfolding drama.
So prior to the game, Ralf Rangnick was asked which Manchester United players would be available. He informed us that Edison Cavani asked for some personal time following his World Cup qualifiers, as Cavani often does. And then he also informed us that Jesse Lingard had asked for a few personal days to get his head right based on the turbulent January transfer window. The fact that he didn't move, the fact that he was told he could leave, the fact that on the day of January 31st, he was told he could leave and go to Newcastle if the right deal could be struck. And then as the day progressed, he was informed actually, no, he would not and would have to stay. So that was what Rangnick informed us. Not too long after that, Jesse Lingard said that he was told by the club that he could do this. Rather than Jesse Lingard telling the club he wants some days off, he tweeted words to the effect of the club offered me this personal time and he would always perform with 100% professionalism when called upon. So this is now the, I'd say, third incident where Ralf Rangnick's candidness in a press conference has led to the disapproval or a certain Manchester United player having their nose put out of joint, which is a curious thing.
Mm.
I think this largely comes down to Ralf Rangnick essentially being very much, if you ask him a question, he's going to give you the answer, and he doesn't really care for protecting certain players or circling the wagons in the way that his predecessor might have. And I think that's caused maybe sort of a cold swimming pool shock to some of these players going, oh no, my manager's actually not going to say nothing's going on, you know, look away. He will actually say X, Y, Z. Again, much like I said after the Martial incident, I don't know who's telling the truth. I'll only say there's probably varying degrees of the truth and something's probably in the middle. But I think if Jesse Lingard wants to take some days out after what was a pretty unsatisfactory January transfer window and has been a rather unsatisfactory season for him so far, by all means, he should take that time away. At full-time, Mr. Rangnick also said, I'm calling him Mr. Rangnick because he speaks in a very adult voice and wears glasses. There you go. He also said words to the effect of he had one less senior player on the substitute bench, alluding to Lingard and Lingard's decision to do that, which felt a very unnecessary dig of the knife there. But at this point in time, I think Jesse Lingard should be getting a lot of minutes for Manchester United between now and the end of the season, if only because he's now second to Jadon Sancho in the hierarchy of players to play on the right. He can also back up Bruno Fernandes in the number 10 position. And, I mean, if Rangnick wants to play high-pressing football that relies on people being dedicated on their off-the-ball work, you should play Jesse Lingard. So this proxy weird war of words should, I hope that gets dealt with quite quickly.
All right, Borough go through, though, and they'll be facing Spurs in the fifth round. Spurs, who looked rampant in a 3-1 victory over Brighton. As Son Heung-min back and doing his thing with Harry Kane. Flo, your QPR were not rampant as you went out to Championship strugglers Peterborough.
Yeah, one of the teams with the worst goal records in the whole of the EFL, but QPR failed to score a goal against them. I think kind of what we were saying earlier about Bournemouth and Forest, there is, you know, a much bigger thing at play this season for QPR with a serious chance of going up to the Premier League either automatically or through the playoffs. So I wouldn't say it's the end of the world to get knocked out at this stage, but a bit like Matt said, when you're facing a team like Peterborough who are struggling, I think it's frustrating for fans, especially as a massive away following went. I mean, like the whole season, there's been really, really good away following for QPR. So I think fans were really disappointed at kind of the manner of the performance. Chris Willock as well was really missed there. He's had a brilliant season for QPR. So I think all in all, it's probably for the best. But I think it is frustrating when kind of fans feel like they're not given a performance that perhaps they deserve.
Right. And certainly if you subscribe to the Flo and Matt FA Cup's all very well, but sooner or later you're going to meet Man City school of thought, then you're not going to worry too much, because that's exactly who Peterborough are going to be facing next, having got past Rangers. Excellent. Well, there are loads of other stories in the FA Cup this weekend. Any other ones you want to pick out? Matt, I know you were commentating on Chelsea making heavy weather of Plymouth, almost getting taken to penalties here.
Yeah, and like I said with Boreham Wood, you know, Plymouth came with a great tactical plan, which is particularly impressive given that their manager is 37-year-old Stephen Schumacher, who's definitely done fewer than 15 games in charge since he replaced his best mate Ryan Lowe, who went to Preston. He was in charge of the Everton under-11 team not too long ago, Schumacher, so it's an incredible step up. But they played with two strikers, which stopped Chelsea being able to bring the ball out from the back with Christensen and Rudiger in the way that they would have liked, and that seemed to really, really affect Chelsea. Could have been different because Chelsea hit the woodwork three times in the first half, and if one of them had gone in, then they might well have gone on to an easy victory. But poor Ryan Hardy at the end, you know, he gets the penalty to make it 2-2, deep in extra time in front of the 6,000 Plymouth fans who were there, and you could see him kind of shaking as he went to take the penalty. It was a poorly struck one. And whether Kepa's got a bit of a psychological advantage on people these days, because people know he's really good at saving penalties, I'm not sure. But he didn't have to work very hard to stop this one. And then, yeah, as soon as the final whistle went, poor Hardy just crumpled to his knees and looked as if he wanted the ground to swallow him up, which was a difficult watch. But yeah, Chelsea far from at their best and needed goals from two fullbacks when they had about 250 million quid's worth of attacking talent on the pitch, which isn't a great sign.
I see. All right, then. A quick mention for Crystal Palace. A, because of how amazing Michael Olise was once again as they got past Hartlepool, and also the fantastic donation that the club and the fans have got together to make to help support Hartlepool manager Graham Lee's wife, who's facing some serious medical conditions and associated expenses. So there you go. Palace will be hosting Stoke in the next round. It's Borough, Spurs, Luton Town against Chelsea, Everton against Boreham Wood, Peterborough, Man City, Forest, Huddersfield, Liverpool, Norwich and Saints, West Ham. That's the start of March, round five. Next up, let's talk about the AFCON final.
We all enjoy the sport we call the beautiful game.
But since I've retired, I've discovered an ugly, even darker side to the sport we love. Join me as Jamie Redknapp investigates.
Thanks, Jamie. We'll take it from here. Join Jamie Redknapp for Jamie Investigates, the football mockumentary series. Watch on Paddy Power's Twitter. This week, Jamie investigates people who still call the Premier League the Premiership.
Do you know the truth?
Paddy Power.
18+BeGambleAware.org.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Well, luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Sunday night in Cameroon, Sadio Mane with the final kick in the penalty shootout to see Senegal beat Egypt and become African champions for the first time. Here's what it sounded like on Senegalese radio.
Sadio Mane qui a le sacre au bout du pied.
Sadio Mane.
La Sénégal champion d'Afrique.
La Sénégal champion d'Afrique.
La Sénégal champion d'Afrique. La Sénégal champion d'Afrique.
Well, joining us now on the line from Cameroon, the morning after, the night before, it is Maher Mazahi. Hi, Maher, how are you?
Hey, I'm okay. Very tired. It was a late night for me last night, as I imagine was for many many of my Senegalese brothers and sisters, but very happy to have finished another African Cup of Nations.
Right. And did you get the ending you wanted?
Yeah, you know, I thought before the match that it would be better to have Senegal win this. On the whole, Egypt probably didn't deserve to win. They didn't play the brand of football that we all like to watch. But I felt bad for Egypt as well. You always kind of feel like a parent when two teams play like this. And you have two players like Mane and Salah who are so, so likable. You don't want either of them to lose, really. But yeah, I think I did want Senegal to win.
Okay. How would you put this down in the kind of pantheon of great Senegal games? Is it even better than the World Cup win over France 20 years ago?
Yesterday, I was speaking to my brother Babacar Diarra from BBC Africa, and he was saying, you know, they have a World Cup playoff in March against Egypt, actually. It's a home and away, and for a place in Qatar 2022. So we're going to see these two sides go at it at least two more times. And he was telling me, yeah, like the priority is to win this Cup of Nations. We don't care about the World Cup at the moment, which shows you that really the magnitude of this match. Because, you know, a lot of people like decried the football that was played. And I really understand that. Trust me, I do. It was boring for all of us. But when you consider, like me, when I watch football, you have to take into account the entire context. And when you think about the fact that since 1965, Senegal have been coming to a Cup of Nations, and they've had heartbreak after heartbreak after heartbreak. In 65, they were eliminated on, you know, a goal average rule, which is, I think you guys already spoke about goal average. It's ridiculous. In 92, they hosted the tournament for the first time. High hopes, bounced in the quarterfinals to Cameroon. 2002, AFCON final, losing in the penalty shootout to Cameroon. 2017, Sadio Mane misses a crucial penalty, loses to Cameroon as well. You have to understand, like, these players are bearing the weight of, you know, these historic wrongs that were sort of done to their country. Sadio Mane, when he missed that penalty in 2017, his uncle's car got vandalized, his home got vandalized. He didn't take a penalty again for Senegal for another year and a bit. So it really traumatized him. And for him to, like, you know, step up immediately in the third minute to go and take that penalty, and for him to miss again, you have to think that all of this is probably going on through a player's mind. And then he gets the final penalty in the penalty shootout, and he just runs up and just blasts it as hard as he could past the Egyptian goalkeeper, Gebeski. When you take into account all of these details, I think you have a greater appreciation for what's going on. And you don't just focus on, you know, possession play and how many shots and all of that.
Mm. Let's talk about that penalty, that final winning penalty. Just an extraordinary hit given the context and the history behind it, the personal history for Sadio Mane, and also the state he seemed to be in before stepping up to the spot, really, really agitated.
Yeah, from the press box, we could see him, you know, between each penalty kick, we could see him sort of drift off away from the line of Senegalese players that were standing at half. And for us, he looked very nervous because it seemed like he was just pacing around in circles. I don't know. Apparently, somebody told me that on TV he seemed actually quite calm. So I don't know. I didn't see the TV copy yet. But it looked like he was pacing and really nervous. So for me, I thought like, yeah, this is going to be a difficult one, especially since the Egyptian goalkeeper, Gebeski. Mm. I don't know if you guys have seen this or not, but he with his team of goalkeeping coaches and the other goalkeepers, before they go into penalty shootouts, they print off the Senegalese players or any opponent's players' recent penalties, and they tape it to a water bottle that he then wraps up into a towel and he takes with him. And you can see him, like, whenever he's getting ready to step up to face another penalty taker, he just kneels for, like, 10 seconds, looking at the player that's advancing towards him, the number, and then he's like, okay, so this is Kalidou Koulibaly, and then he'll, like, look at his water bottle. He's pretending, he's trying to do it in a very slick manner, but everybody can see that he's doing it. And then he sees, okay, Kalidou Koulibaly goes to the left, and it actually works. Like, he dove in the right direction 4 out of 5 times. During the penalty shootout, he obviously saved Sadio Mane's penalty. He had really good performances in penalty shootouts against Cameroon and the Ivory Coast as well. So with all of that going through Mane's mind, he just ran up really fast. And like you said, I felt like he hit it with the force of all of those historic failures behind him, all that frustration, all that angst, right past Gebeski. And yeah, then it was just catharsis, pure catharsis for all of the players and staff.
Maher, what was it like in the stadium? Because on the TV, it seemed like such an emotional release for so many, especially the coaching staff and the players. But in terms of the fans in the stadium, were they swaying more towards Senegal or Egypt? Because I feel like on social media, it certainly felt like a lot of people wanted Mane and Senegal to win.
Yeah, it was similar in the stadium. I was pitch side pretty much. And I was there when the players were coming out, and immediately I noticed that when Senegal trotted out, they were cheered, and when Egypt came out, they were booed, with the exception of Mohamed Salah. He's still a very popular person and player over here. So speaking of what happened after Mane scored that goal, there were actually 2 Senegalese journalists that had fainted in the press box and had to be stretchered down. They would be end up being okay, but just to tell you, like, the emotional toll that, like, all of this has taken on some of these people. So there's that. I saw Aliou Cissé at full time, same thing, hug his assistant coaches for maybe 15, 20 seconds. And then he too just fell to the ground, and he stayed there for another 30, 45 seconds. The Senegalese goalkeeper who had missed in the penalty shootout in the 2002 AFCON final against Cameroon. And he was just sobbing, you know, just crying. So many players were just really, really emotional. After the game, they're dedicating the victory to, you know, former teammates that had passed away, former coaches like Bruno Metsu, who was in charge in the 2002 World Cup. All of these things sort of go through your head, you know, when you win a tournament, you think about all the people that couldn't be here. It was definitely an emotional moment. The president of Senegal, Macky Sall, congratulating everybody. And then all you have to do is take a quick Google search of Dakar and look at the celebrations, and you'll see yourself. I don't think they're going to sleep until the team arrives and they have a proper hero's welcome.
Magnificent. Mo Salah, Egypt, multiple winners of this tournament, but not with Mo Salah in the ranks. How was his game?
Yeah, it's difficult being Mo Salah. You know, life's not easy. It's a hard knock life for him with the Egyptian national team. They really don't play a great attacking brand of football, unfortunately for him. He's the only real attacking outlet for Egypt, who tend to soak up pressure, hoof it up to him, hoping he performs a miracle, which sometimes he very well does. In the second half, usually they bring on Aston Villa's Trezeguet or Zamalek Zizou, and that kind of helps out. Adds some speed to the side, but it's not easy being him. I've seen a statistical comparison between Salah with Liverpool and Salah with Egypt, and just in every single category, in terms of touches in the opponent's box, in terms of goals, assists, shots, it's just much, much higher with Liverpool. So until Egypt changes their brand of football, and they did play a good brand of football from 2006 to 2010, but under Carlos Queiroz and with this team, I don't expect him to be as productive.
No, fair enough. All right, well, as you mentioned, they will be taking on Senegal again in 7 weeks' time in that two-legged playoff for a place at the World Cup. Before we let you go, though, Maher, tell us about a much better game which took place on Saturday night, the third fourth playoff.
Yeah, between Cameroon and Burkina Faso. I was really happy for Burkina Faso at first because I kind of wanted them to get a win with all that's going on in their country. Of course, there was a coup on the 23rd of January, and they got off to a roaring start, 3-0. Cameroon did not play any of their starters. They had a full rotation. So they left Vincent Aboubakar, Karl Toko Ekambi. All their real starters were on the bench, but especially in attack. And yeah, so Burkina Faso got off to a 3-0 start, and you kind of think this match is over. Sure enough, Cameroon bring on Vincent Aboubakar at halftime. They bring on Karl Toko Ekambi, and they managed to pull it back, 3-3. And Vincent Aboubakar scores two goals, bringing his total to 8 goals, which is the most we've ever seen in an African Cup of Nations since 1974, when Ndé Moulamba scored the record 9 goals. So that was just a really great tournament from his part. For me, probably the player of the tournament, even though Sadio Mane was voted as such yesterday. Another great penalty shootout, but yeah, it was good to see Cameroon come away with some silverware. I think they deserved it. I think on the whole, they were a bit unlucky to go to Egypt, so it was good to see them win the third place match, which you don't really care about until you're third place, and then it's just like a nice way to go home.
Absolutely, Aboubakar, 8 goals, which is twice as many as the entire Egypt team managed in the entire tournament. So there you go, Maher. Well, there you go. So as you say, AFCON comes to an end. A final memory from Cameroon to leave us with until we speak again?
Yeah, I'm thinking of Aliou Cissé, his press conference. 4 or 5 players barging in, dousing him in water, and then a media officer saying, "What have I done to deserve this?" And pretty much ending the press conference and him just saying, "Sorry, my guys have stirred shit up again." Yeah, but Cameroon was great. I think if you ever have a chance to get out here, definitely do it. Me, myself, I am heading back on a bus to Douala. Going to try to have some plantain chips again before I leave, and I fly out tonight. So it's been really good speaking to everybody and updating you all from here, and we hope we can speak again soon.
Thanks for your great work. I've really enjoyed reading all of your dispatches from Cameroon over the tournament.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's been fabulous having you on. I think everyone's really enjoyed it, Maher, and I hope you're going to be joining us soon. I hope you also got to some jazz clubs in Cameroon.
I did.
You did? Okay, excellent.
I'll send this to you on DM after.
Perfect. Okay. Safe travels then on your way back home, and look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
The great Maher Mazahi. Ooh, in AFCON news, Carl, what's all this about Chris Hughton being the new Ghana manager?
Yes. Oh, come on. This has been
come
long,
on, can we have the Ghana-Egypt final?
It's
imagine
been long,
the football there.
Oh, blimey. It's been long gestating since Ghana's highly disappointing AFCON performance. And it looks as if the announcement will be made official sometime during this week. I know Gary Al-Smith has been saying the deal has basically been done since Friday. There's also been some reported images of Chris Hughton talking to Callum Hudson-Odoi's family, which I thought was quite interesting considering Hudson-Odoi has 3 senior England caps. So he could still yet change allegiances to Ghana. The big thing for Ghana is in 6-7 weeks, they have a 2-legged World Cup qualifier against Nigeria, which is essentially the biggest derby in sub-Saharan African football. Certainly the biggest derby among the English-speaking nations. Nigeria have just changed their manager following Uwevegun's restoration to the technical director role. So both of these countries are very much got 6 or 7 weeks to plan for qualifying for the World Cup against the country they essentially hate the most in footballing terms. So while Matt has laughed and has...
I think it's a good appointment. I don't think it's a Bart Simpson ha-ha. I think it's a...
It's a really intriguing one. If he was given a technical director role and was told essentially, you know, do what you're doing possibly with Callum Hudson-Odoi's family. Go out and find every single eligible dual national that is living in England, the Netherlands, Italy, France and whatnot, and see who's out there who can play for Ghana and get them to realise that the Ghanaian Football Association is not a complete basket case. Then, yes, I very much believe he'd be excellent at the role. And I'm sure a large reason why he is being touted for the managerial job is because he will probably be doing this in some capacity, right? You look right now, Mohamed Salisu, Southampton centre-back, who was phenomenal against Manchester City recently, has not featured for the national team since 2019, where he dropped out due to injury problems and basically said, I'm not going to play for Ghana for reasons and that they need to sort themselves out. So as a manager, we know he is a... I don't
drab
want to say
is the word you're looking for, Carl. Drab and dreary.
I know Carl's going to say pragmatic to put a positive spin on things.
But... I'm going to say I don't want to say pragmatic because pragmatic. If you're pragmatic and you look at Ghana's squad, you'd go, okay, we'll flood central midfield and just chuck in loads of crosses, and we can actually play a little bit. But right. I do worry that Chris Hutton will just go, you know, let's just try and grind out 1-0 victories against Nigeria because Nigeria are better.
But that's what Ghana have been trying to do for so long.
That's
really
the problem.
Badly.
That's the problem. Ghana's had a lot of coaches in the last 20, well, essentially since their 2008, 2013, 14 heyday. They've had a lot of high turnover in coaches. The Avram Grant era was particularly bad. And like many big teams that go through managerial crises, the only reason you do get the sense that every manager is being hired because they're the opposite of what the previous manager was.
Mm. Matt, your right reply on Chris Hutton?
Well, put it this way. I went to Forest's first game of the season, first game back with a full stadium after lockdown, and his team were booed off at half time, and it didn't get much better than that. I mean, he has one way of playing. It obviously comes with a caveat, tremendous bloke, etc. and so on. And if he's there to do what Carl says, i.e. Yep. charm scout. People and talk people in and scout, he'll be great at that. But if you have to, if you're going to Callum Hudson-Odoi and saying, come play for Ghana, I'm going to coach the team, then that is not going to convince him to switch allegiance. He'd rather play no international football than Chris Hutton international football. But it would be, I mean, it's too early on a Monday morning for me to get my head around Chris Hutton managing a team at a World Cup. But,
all right. Well, can I just ask on behalf of everybody who's not been keeping track of what the FIFA regulations are about switching allegiances internationally, you were saying Callum Hudson-Odoi has featured three times for the senior England side and therefore can still swap. What's the kind of parameter now?
Last year with Mejia contributing a fantastic piece for The Athletic, we looked at as to how these rules have changed, and it's largely due to the work of the Algerian FA in the early 2000s, who essentially lobbied and petitioned FIFA and went, please look at all these fantastic French-Algerian players who have got under 19 French caps, under 21 French caps, and no senior caps. Can we have some of them?
Right.
And I think the first appearance in 2006? In 2010 World Cup was the beginning of their sort of new generation of dual nationals. This was then capitalised again. So I think Algeria's lobbying essentially made if you had no senior appearances, you could swap, but you know, under 21s didn't lock you in. And then right. Morocco's did essentially work on the following things to say, can we limit the amount of senior appearances? So now three is the most. If you have fewer than three appearances for a national team and you're dual national, you can swap. You've also seen this very quickly happen with the Jamaican national team. So now Mikel Antonio is a Jamaican international because he hadn't, you know, won the as Mejia once said, it's quite fun to watch. No one gets a passport quicker than when an international football player switching allegiances. Things get just stamped very, 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 very quickly. So
you've not been
this
to Malta then?
I have not. Is it good?
No, it's lovely. Just on the passport front. But yeah.
So this AFCON was quite interesting because it was the first major AFCON with these three caps rule changes. So Nigeria had the largest dual national contingent in Nigerian footballing history. And I think we will see this more from World Cup to World Cup and AFCON to AFCON. So next year's AFCON that will happen in July in the Ivory Coast will have plenty of dual national players, including Wilfried Zaha.
Brilliant. I think as well with Callum Hudson-Odoi, I think why there's probably quite a positive chance is that he's been heading over to Ghana at every opportunity. Winter break, he was straight on a plane, straight over to Ghana. Obviously, he's got family there and likes to holiday there. But it does feel like he's got a bigger connection than perhaps other dual national players, Danny Welbeck being one of them, who I think Carl will be able to mention a lot of Ghanaian fans are still a bit sore about the fact that he chose to play for England over Ghana. So I think there is, it seems like there's quite a strong chance there, and it may not take a lot for Chris Hughton to persuade him. But I still feel quite positive about this Chris Hughton appointment. So, you know, if Ghana beat England at the World Cup, Matt, maybe you'll be eating your words.
yeah, maybe.
Indeed. Maybe. All right. There you go. Well, still to come on today's bumper Totally Football Show. Quick roundup of some of the other things that happened this weekend, and also a throw forward to the midweek Premier League action.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which will come in handy when Mikel Arteta finally bins the process altogether. Pre-match bet builders only get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Maximum free bet is £10. Other T's and C's apply, and please gamble responsibly.
Totally Football League Show is out with the always excellent Matt Davis-Adams on this Monday. Matt, you're going to be talking about League One leaders Rotherham, who were 1-0 up against Accrington Stanley with a couple of minutes to go. Stanley got awarded a penalty. Then what happened?
Some dope from the crowd came on and kicked the ball away, and then they eventually took the penalty and missed it. And it's kind of, it's funny in a way, but it's the context of it is changed slightly from what happened at Forest on Sunday, I think. But, I mean, we'll get the inside track on this because we've got Joe Jacobson with us for the whole show today, who is the captain of Wycombe Wanderers, and he was an absolute delight. He's always great, great value. So I'll ask him, I think, about how players are feeling, because people have just gone mad, haven't they? Like going to football games and coming on the pitch. It seems like a real post-lockdown weird thing that's happening that we definitely need to stop. So, yeah, I mean, it was funny in the Rotherham game. But, yeah, let's stop running on the pitch and making footballers feel unsafe and stuff, shall we?
Indeed so. Totally Football Show European edition. Be with you first thing on Tuesday. Let's see. Barcelona beating up on Atletico Madrid. Top three being only 1 point apart in Italy. Messi scoring a goal. That's all going to be in there. Dramatic stuff with Alvaro and James and Jules. The Athletic Women's Football Podcast is also out on Tuesday. And there's a lot to talk about in that because it was a huge weekend in the Women's Super League. Was it not, Flo? You were at Arsenal's 1-1 draw with Man United on Saturday, featuring pass of the season.
Yeah, it was a weird one. Arsenal probably should have lost that game. Manchester United were by far the better team. Ella Toon had a chance in the second half that she should have put away, and Manchester United should have won the game 2-0. But she somehow misses that one-on-one opportunity. And then about 8 minutes later, Arsenal get the equaliser with an unbelievable Miedemar pass into their new signing, Blackstenius, who scores her first goal for Arsenal. They've shown a lot of fighting spirit over the last couple of weeks because it took a late Tobin Heath equaliser against Manchester City to rescue a point there too. So I think in that sense it's positive because they'd look like a bit of a broken team recently, especially after defeat to Birmingham City. They kind of looked like they were playing for themselves a little bit and weren't playing together as a unit. But I think these results have brought them together, but they're still not playing very well. And I think they've got a game against Chelsea on Friday night, and that is going to be huge. And I think looking at the way Chelsea have been playing recently, I feel like Chelsea are going to win that game, and that's going to really probably put Arsenal's title hopes to bed, because Chelsea's win over City yesterday took them within 2 points of Arsenal, and they've got a game in hand anyway. So I do think momentum has kind of swung back towards Chelsea. But Manchester United deserve a lot of credit for the last couple of weeks, that they've played some really good football. And I think the way they're playing has really shifted from when they lost to Arsenal back in November. They look like a lot better team. They've got really, really good sort of front three, front four, who are just playing really aggressively, taking their chances. Their defence is still weak at times, but I think, you know, they're giving themselves a really good shot of qualifying for Europe for the first time. And given, you know, their pretty new outfit, it's been a very quick rise over the last couple of years.
Magnificent. All right, well, so Arsenal taking on Chelsea, as you say, just 2 points between them this Friday night. Currently Man United in third, 3 points themselves behind Chelsea in third. All right. Also coming up this week, Chelsea featuring in the Club World Cup. Matt Davis-Adams on Wednesday, they'll be taking on
Al Hilal.
Good. And then if they get past Al Hilal, on Saturday, they'll be in the final against, well, we don't know, but the form book would suggest Palmeiras.
Yeah, that seems most likely. Obviously, Chelsea will hope to have Thomas Tuchel available for the final should they reach there. He's not going to be...
He's self-isolating.
Yeah, tested positive for COVID on the morning of Saturday's game. So we'll see what effect if that has, if any. But it's a tricky one, the Club World Cup, isn't it? I mean, Chelsea will be delighted that they're in this edition of it rather than the proposed 2014 format, which would have taken place were it not for COVID. But you just feel like it always means so much more to the South American sides than it does to the European teams, and that can quite often define it. But on a personal note, I'd love Chelsea to win it just so that Cesar Azpilicueta can say that he's won every available club trophy while he's been at Chelsea. That would be quite nice.
Who did they face last time they were in it?
Corinthians, they lost to...
On penalties,
yeah,
I believe.
And Rafa Benitez. Rafa in, yeah.
There's a great photograph of a very disgruntled Fernando Torres at the end of the shootout. It's I'll be interested to see how Mr. Infantino convolutes the trophy lifting ceremony in Club World Cup, considering his frankly ridiculous shenanigans at the AFCON final.
There were too many shenanigans from lots of people in suits yesterday, Infantino being king of the shenanigans, but just so much main character energy, so many people taking the moment away from the players, which really, really frustrated me.
Infantino is basically copying the Sepp Blatter playbook with his treatment of African football. So obviously that's the new proposition for the African Super League, which will create a closed shop in a continent that absolutely doesn't need a closed shop and will make travel impossible if that goes through. There is some rumour and conjecture about qualification places for the new structure of the World Cup. Obviously a lot of conversation. Depending on what feed you watch the AFCON final, you might have saw Yaya Toure say winning the AFCON means so much because, well, you know, to copy a bit of Matt, there are Man Cities in the World Cup, bigger European nations. So winning the World Cup as an African nation is nigh on impossible. So you have to win your AFCON when you can win your AFCON. We are seeing a lot more of Infantino talk about African football and make comments about African football. Right. And I don't believe a word of what he's saying, because I've seen this before with Sepp Blatter trying to secure more votes to secure his power as a FIFA president. So I'm very wary of his influence in an AFCON trophy lift and what he's essentially going to say and do during this Club World Cup.
Mm. If you're not a fan, by the way, of bald men making egregious comments about football, steer clear of Channel 4's coverage of the Club World Cup, because I'm going to be hosting it. It's on E4 on Wednesday, and then on Saturday on actual Channel 4, with whoever's in that, you imagine Chelsea, but me doing football on Channel 4, quite a thought. All right, midweek Premier League as well. It's all over BT Sport, 9 games. Quickly running through these. Newcastle facing Everton, who are only 4 points above them. This is on Tuesday. Newcastle's fellow bottom three sides, Watford, will be at West Ham that night. And Burnley host Man United with Carl Anker attending. Wednesday, Man City, Brentford. Brentford's first ever trip to the Etihad, that. Norwich are up against Crystal Palace. Norwich are an absolute... they're on fire right now. 4 wins from 5 so far this year. Spurs are up against Southampton. Aston Villa, Leeds. And on Thursday, Liverpool take on Leicester and Wolves host Arsenal. Of course, there's already been one Premier League game that happened this weekend. Don't know if anyone was across this. It was a goalless draw at Turf Moor, Burnley against Watford.
That sure was a game of football that happened.
Did you, when you say was anybody across this, James, do you mean out of us three? Or because I was wondering if anybody who doesn't support Burnley or Watford or works in the football industry would have watched this game. Oh, Charlie.
Producer Charlie watched it. Producer Charlie. What did you think, Producer Charlie?
Dour,
says Producer Charlie. Of course, it was Roy Hodgson's first game in charge of the Hornets. And lo and behold, it was their first Premier League clean sheet in 31 games. Have some of that. Anyway, we can see if he can pull off that trick again as they host West Ham on Tuesday. Well, apart from that, apart from obviously that, what else are you looking forward to from the midweek round?
Need to see something from Brentford, I think, fairly soon. I mean, they're obviously very unlikely to go to Manchester City and win, but they're 8 points above Watford, who are third bottom, and they've played two games more than them. They've lost their last five, only scored more than once in one of the last seven Premier League games. They're in danger of getting dragged into it, I think, if they're not careful.
It'll be still too early for Christian Eriksen to be featuring for the Bees, I imagine, is it?
Presumably. It'll be a strange game to throw him into, I guess. Mm.
Yeah, all right.
I'll be interested to see Everton's new look, central midfield. Grace Robinson, fantastic at Grace on Football, often says that some managers, you can often see when a manager is trying to replicate the playing environment of their playing days, almost to win a philosophical argument. And you can, it looks as if Frank Lampard is trying to create a central midfield that's just full of third man runs. Just like, yep, Donny's a 3-8, Daly's going to be a 3-8, Decore, good luck, but we're just going to run and make late entries into the penalty area. So if either Donny van der Beek or Dele can feature this midweek, I'll be interested in that. I'm also going to be interested to see what Burnley are going to do with their new 6'6" striker, Wout Weghorst.
Vote Weghorst.
I think he's going to have
appropriate because it's all about crosses in the box with him.
He's going to have a very interesting duel with Harry Maguire on Tuesday, so I'll be looking forward to see how that works out. Because I think Harry Maguire, he could do with a nice performance soon, because I think quite a few football fans have forgotten how good Harry Maguire was for the majority of 2021, and how he legitimately was one of the better centre-backs in the country, if not in Europe, for a good chunk of last year.
Very nice, Carl. Flo?
I think Everton, definitely I agree with Carl. From their highlights, it does seem like they're moving the ball a lot quicker than they did under Benitez, which I definitely think is a positive thing that Lampard's already brought into the side. So I'm interested to see how they carry that on, because I think there's some green shoots there, but I'm still a little bit intrigued by this Lampard appointment. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
I like the fact that he's changed up his coaching team a bit, by the way. I think that shows a sign of evolution. I think that's what Fergie always did so well, wasn't it? And what it took Jose Mourinho far too long to start doing. So the fact that he's done that in his third job, I think, shows that he's kind of learning that he needs to adapt a bit and change a bit. And Wolves-Arsenal on Thursday as well, by the way. That one feels big to me. There's absolutely no excuse for Arsenal not to finish fourth in the league this year, but that's a difficult game for them.
Okay, also on Thursday, Liverpool-Leicester. We've talked about Leicester's issues and the miserable time that their supporters are having could well continue at Anfield. They've met twice, actually, in recent weeks. In December, a couple of games, a 3-3 at Anfield in the League Cup. The Reds going through on penalties. Leicester, meanwhile, 1-0 winners at the King Power in the Premier League that month as well. There you go. They could do with the result on Thursday. Super stuff. All right, well, of course, the two Thursday games we won't be able to cover, but the rest of the matches will be here on Thursday morning with another Totally Football show on our reactions to all the shocks and surprises therein. For now, though, that brings us to the end of today's edition. Many thanks, listener, for joining us. Many thanks to producer Charlie for his always excellent input, Matt Davis-Adams, Flo Lloyd-Hughes, Carl Anker, and we'll be back on Thursday, so we'll see you then.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.